talk to you for a moment about yogurt. Now, I'm an Armenian, you know, so we're the experts on yogurt. So I want to tell you how to make yogurt. There may be some of you women who have made a try of it and done rather poorly, which is easy to do. And I want to tell you how to make yogurt. What you do is you get some milk. You put it in a pan, and you heat it. And then, at just the right temperature, you get a little bit of starter from the old batch and insert it into the hot milk. And you have yogurt. Okay? Oh, I know what some of you women are thinking. What is the exact temperature in which you would, at which time you insert the starter? Oh, well, that's easy to answer. What you do is you put your finger in the milk, and if that milk temperature has the right feel, that's when you put the starter in. Okay? It's very easy to miss making yogurt correctly, because the difficulty in so doing is to know what the exact temperature is. Now, I put my finger in lots of batches of hot milk, and I put the starter in when I thought it was just right, and all I got was curdled milk. And it takes a little doing to know exactly the exact temperature at which to put in the starter. Now, I tell you that little illustration because we want to focus this morning on the significance of the crucial moment. The exact temperature is the crucial moment for that starter going into that warm milk in order to make yogurt. Charles Spurgeon was a 19th century Baptist pastor in London about 100 years ago, and among the many fine things that he said was this: failure in the crucial moment of our lives may well sink those lives, may well mar the outcome of an entire life. Failure at the crucial moment. Now, our lives are regularly marked by occasions for momentous decision-making. I used to think that those moments for those significant moments were relatively few and far between. But I have an idea on further reflection, in my own mind at least, that those moments come every day. Every day, I believe, we are faced with crucial decisions. To choose wrongly may well mar, as Spurgeon says, our entire lives, may well ruin a reputation or a name many years have gone into to build up. Or to simply make more difficult, unnecessarily difficult, living. To choose rightly, on the other hand, can enhance reputation, can bolster self-confidence, can confirm us further in righteousness. I'd like to have you turn to Daniel chapter 3, and we're going to look into the lives of four Hebrew men: Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And in the opening chapters of this book, you know, there are a number of these crucial experiences, moments, in the lives of these men at which, during which, they must make the better choice. Let's begin chapter 3, verse 15. In the middle of verse 15, Nebuchadnezzar, the king, the Babylonian dictator, says, "If you do not worship this image that had been set up in the land, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the golden image which you have set up." He set up this image, and he said, anyone who fails to bow down to this idol will receive a one-way ticket to a burning, fiery furnace. Now, here are three men in this chapter, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who are captives in Babylon, removed from their homeland in Palestine, hundreds of miles to the east, and one day are faced with a crucial decision to make. To bow down to that idol would be to go against everything that they had been taught as Jews, would be to violate the commandment of God against such, to be against everything that they had been trained to believe. On the other hand, to obey the king or to refuse to obey would be to face a horrible death. Now, the question before us this morning is, how could these chapter, at least these three men, respond as they did in the three verses that we just read? I mean, this man had the power of death over their lives. He could easily cast them into the den of lions, into a fiery furnace, chop their heads off. And yet they said, King Nebuchadnezzar, we are not going to obey you. We believe that our God will deliver us from whatever you may wish to do. And if he doesn't, still not going to change our decision. A crucial moment. And I am saying that in all of our lives, today and tomorrow, we again will be faced with a temptation or some event at which occasion we must make a decision, for good or for ill. How shall we make the right decision? How did these three men decide in the face of their particular problem? This is the question that I wish to try to at least make some suggestive answers. First of all, they could do what they did. They could respond to the king as they did because, one, of their previous commitment to God. Now, we may go back to chapter 1. Because these three men with Daniel appear in chapter 1. And in chapter 1, and I'm not going through the history of these stories because I take it you know that many of you have learned these years ago. But in chapter 1, we discover that these three men, together with Daniel, refrain from the palace diet that was put before them because they were now appointed, especially among the many who had been taken captive, to live and to be trained in the palace for governmental positions. But they refrained to eat the food that was placed before them. Why did they choose to refrain from eating the food? Well, it doesn't really say in all that clarity, but I think we can make a good guess or two. It probably was because of the Mosaic dietary restrictions, which required the eating of certain foods only and not eating certain foods. And here were foods, we might say, were offered to idols beforehand. And therefore, for that reason, perhaps, they refrained from the food. Verse 8 says that Daniel, and the whole chapter says the other three men as well, purposed in their hearts to not defile themselves with the king's food nor with the wine with which he drank. Food that had been first dedicated to the gods or was related to the gods in some way, would ensure the favor of those gods to those who ate. And those who ate by thereby eating that kind of food offered to the gods would gain the favor of those gods. And eating that food would also be tantamount to their implicit acceptance of the existence of those gods. Now, to you and to me in America, this is an oddity. But to my Singaporean students, Chinese, many of whom have come out of Buddhist families, who were perhaps once Buddhist themselves, and have been converted to Christ, and yet their parents are still Buddhists. And these children, still living with their parents, have a problem about food eaten in the home that was first offered to idols. And those Christians have a problem. Should they eat that food? They would say to themselves, well, the scriptures say an idol is nothing in this world. Yeah, you should eat whatever God puts in your hand. But yet, on the other hand, to eat that food would be to say, this eating recognizes the existence of these idols and the goodwill of those idols. And the students have a real problem. Christian young men and women who come out of Buddhist families with parents still in the Buddhist fold have a real problem with this. So here we have these men. What should they do? Daniel purposed with the three friends in his heart to refrain, to abstain from the food. Verse 8 literally says, Daniel placed it upon his heart. He committed himself to it. He determined that whatever would happen during the days of his arrest, during the days of that captivity in Babylon, whatever challenge was placed before him, it would be measured in terms of their commitment to God. This was not a commitment to be lightly made and then soon forgotten, but a commitment to be made and kept, and all decisions measured by that commitment. For these three men to be faithful to that decision relative to their God, they must go against the order of the king. To be faithful to God, they must risk their reputation. But yet, on the other hand, they could rationalize and say, well, we're far from home. We're miles away from Palestine. We're separated from our families. What difference would it make if we ate this food? It's good food. It's the king's table. Furthermore, God, they might have said, has kind of left us in the lurch. That God was not very protective of us in Palestine, permitting this heathen to come into our land and destroy the land and to kill its people and to raise the temple and loot its holy vessels. God let us down. So why should we jeopardize our lives now for him? Did you ever think those thoughts? God did me in once. God left me in the lurch once. I remember, you might say, that there was a time when I was really in the pits and I sought God. And he was nowhere around. So why should I decide, make a decision for him? He sure didn't decide for these three fellows and their kin in Palestine. They might have rationalized like that, but they didn't. Because of previous commitment, enabling them to resist the king. And they prospered. The end of chapter 1 says that the three men prospered, and Daniel. Their commitment paid off, in other words. Now, I think it's true, really. It's true in my life. I'm sure it's true in yours. That every day we're faced with crucial decisions of the kind that I'm speaking of. So we have to ask ourselves, do those decisions enhance that I make at those times enhance my life or inhibit my life? How can we make enhance life-enhancing decisions? One way is to be committed to God and stay with that commitment, whatever the price, like these three men. How are you doing in that area of your life? A second way that these three men could respond as they did to the king and more courageously face these kinds of difficult decisions was because not only of previous commitment, but previous successes in the life of faith. God had honored their decision in chapter 1, in that story. And God, they believed, would be faithful, for God never changed. In whatever other like experiences may come along. And they came along. Let's turn to chapter 2. You recall in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. And so he went to his wise men and his astrologers, and these men that's supposed to know such things. And he said, I want you to tell me not only the interpretation, but I want you to tell me the dream. And when his wise men heard that, they thought the king had gone off the deep end. He said, nobody can tell you the dream, for Pete's sake. You've got to tell us the dream, and you tell us the dream, and we'll tell you the interpretation. We can tell you the interpretation. And he as much said, hey, look, I'm the king here. I'll tell you, I laid down the rules here. And the rule is, I want you to tell me what the dream was, as well as the interpretation, and what it means. You read through chapter 2 and you discover that Daniel hears about this, and the three friends hear about it. What do? Well, they go to prayer. Verse 17 of chapter 2. Then Daniel went to his house, made the decision known to his three friends, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret of the king, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Because the king said, look, if you wise men, and if anybody, makes an attempt to tell me the dream and fails, you're all going to die. So they prayed. And God answered that prayer. We're talking about previous successes in the life of faith. In verse 23, Daniel prays to God in thanksgiving. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers, that you have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we four men have asked of you. For you have made known to us the king's demand. Can you imagine? You're going to die. The only thing you need to do to escape death is to tell the king what he dreamed. Now, you think you have problems. Now, you do have problems. Now, I've got problems. Now, I've got big problems. And you've got big problems. But I've not been faced with death. I have not been faced with voracious lions. I have not been faced with a fire. But yet, our experiences have been extremely troubling, as these were in the lives of these men. And great faith was necessary to ask God and believe God to reveal the kind of information that they were asking in the face of incredible odds. And God answered their prayer. Can't take the time to go through that entire chapter. You see, these three men in chapter 3 responded as they did because they had past experiences when they had similar crucial moments when they chose, because of their commitment to God, to stay with God, to stick with God, no matter how dark and how desperate seemed the day. Are you really a Christian? Don't tell me about it. Show me by your faith. I need to see it. I don't need your words. And your brothers and sisters don't need simply your words. They want to see something. And I want to see something. And you want to see something in me, so that we just not be simple purveyors of a confession, but to have lives marked by experiences such as these men. Thirdly, how can we respond so beautifully and so courageously as these did? Thirdly, because of the previous habit of regular, consistent prayer. Now, we turn to chapter 6 for this illustration. Now, there's the story of the den of lions with our friend Daniel again. Daniel is having another one of these very difficult experiences, like he had back in chapter 1, like he had again in chapter 2. And he's facing the lions. So he prays in verse 10. Now when Daniel knew what the decree of the king was against him, he went home And he knelt down on his knees three times that day. And he prayed and he gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Notice the last phrase. He prayed, well, two things. In the middle of the verse, he prayed three times that day. I imagine he prayed three times. He may have prayed a few more. But at least the record says he prayed three times. If I am faced with lions, I'm going to pray at least three times. I have an idea. I might pray 33 times that day. And a few more times, maybe two or three more times the next day, if the lions haven't gotten me yet. But not only did he pray three times that day, but he was, the last phrase says, in the habit of consistently praying. The verbs in the verse suggest continuous prayer. How could these men respond as they did to the difficulties of their life? I'm saying thirdly, because of a previous life of consistent, fervent, expectant prayer. Now, this was true of Daniel here in chapter 6. It was true of his three companions. We've already seen that. Now, that Daniel practiced a consistent life of prayer is indicated by the plan of his enemies to strike at his religious life, which evidently was open before all to see. In chapter 6 and verse 5, his opponents who wanted to get him said, "We shall find no charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." They sought to have his high commitment to God work against him. They couldn't find anything bad about him. The worst about him was his best. So they said, well, we'll work on that. And we'll make his good look bad, work against him. And this says, among other things, that Daniel was no secret believer. They knew of his prayer habits each day. He was not one who said, boy, if I stick with this commitment that I made to God some time ago, I'll lose this high position that I have, and I'll be a nobody, or I may be dead. No. He was not a closet Christian. And I just wonder if there is any such thing as a closet Christian. I have an idea that a Christian in his closet is not a Christian. Christians don't live in closets. He didn't cover up. The lions were facing him, but he remained faithful, loyal, true blue to his commitment, because God had already honored that commitment to him and to his three friends. And God constantly says to us, as I'm sure he said to them, I know he said to them, remember how I honored your faith back there? You remember when you prayed back there? And how things turned out for my glory and your good. You remember that? They remembered. Now, to close all this, I believe that the key to moral, social, spiritual success lies in our making right decisions yesterday, in our past. May I emphasize again, underscore again, we have been talking about previous commitments to God, previous successes in the life of faith, previous prayer life, ongoing, started, begun years before. Their past worked together to bless their present. Every opportunity I have to tell my history students, one of the reasons you study history, I say some of you wouldn't choose history if it wasn't chosen for you. It shows you what you know about history. That's what I tell. I like to burn their backsides a little bit once in a while. If you don't know where you've been, you aren't going to know where you are. We don't choose, we don't make decisions, whether good or bad, out of a vacuum. We make them out of our past. We are today what we have been making of ourselves in our yesterdays. And so, if we ask ourselves, why do I act the way I do today? Why do I do these dumb things? Why do I make these poor choices? How is it that I'm forever getting into trouble? How is it that I can't have a good marriage? How is it that I can't seem to get anywhere with God? Well, it must be God's fault. Or it must be my spouse's fault. Or it must be my employer's fault. Or it's got to be the pastor's fault. Never mine. That's for sure. Never my fault. Why is it that I act the way I do? Why is it that I am what I am? It's because I have contributed to being what I am. We are responsible to a large degree, if not entirely, certainly to a large degree, for what we are and how we think and how we choose, particularly in crunch times. As yesterday, therefore, is a key to our behavior today, so today will be most significant in helping shape what kind of a day we have tomorrow. So I say to myself, well, if you want to have a good day tomorrow, one thing that'll contribute, it's not everything, but one thing that will surely help to contribute to have a good day, that is the day that will honor God and bless me, is when I'm faced today with crucial decisions to be faithful to my commitment, to remember God's faithfulness to me in times past, and to, with thanksgiving, seek his face for mercy and help. By way of invitation, I'll say this to you. You good people are, as you've been listening, and the Spirit of God has been speaking to many of you, I believe, you're faced with a decision right now, some of you, if not all of you. And we need, and it's a, I think it's a crucial time. It may be crunch time in your life, whether it's related to your marriage, to some other relationship, to some other brother or sister, some friend that's not, the relationship is not what it ought to be, or whatever. It could be any number of things. Maybe you're involved in a extracurricular affair as a married man or woman. You could make a right decision and get out of that thing, or you could stay in it, make the wrong decision, and kill yourself. That is, ruin your life. Or you can make the right decision and say, today I'm going to get out of that. Now, we don't have the time, and you don't want to hear it, the long list of like kinds of experiences that Christians are having these days. But you may extrapolate for yourself. And I, for myself, I want to make right decisions. But I'm not going to do it unless it's apart from the kinds of things that help these men. And I'd like to have you do that. So the invitation is this. I'll leave it to yourself, in your own heart and mind, before you and God. May God help you to make, in this crucial, significant time of your life, right now, to make the kind of decision that will honor God. If I can help you in that, or some other person that you're more comfortable with can help you, see them.